Okay, so this is a series on the gospel, right? And so last week I gave an introduction, last month. And so today I'm going to talk about creation from the very beginning of time when God says that he is a creator of the universe, all right? So this is what it says in Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. So as Christians, we believe in creationism, all right? And so, in fact, you can see the biblical writer here, Moses, repeats this idea that, you know, he spoke and then things came into being 8 times, at least in that first chapter. And God said, let there be light, and there was light, all right? So what we understand this so-called use of speech as a metaphor, Moses using this metaphor speech, the biblical writer is trying to emphasize that God's creation account, his act of creation, is rational and it is supernatural, right? So God spoke and there is, you know, all these things are being created. And so basically here, the point here is that even from the very beginning of verse 1, 2, and 3 of Genesis, the Bible does not seek to defend the truth of the Christian faith. It just merely assumes it, all right? Because we're using, I mean, we're back then, I don't know how many years before, you know, when you think about Genesis, what is the 340 BC or something like that, 346 BC, the worldview back then, basically everyone just assumes God or the many gods. It's not until we come to the 18th, 19th century of our time that people began to object to any kind of creation or any kind of existence of God. All right, so we're living in that kind of a context. Back then, people just assumed the existence of God and did not seek to defend it. So when I introduce about this topic, when we talk about creationism, all right, does God exist? All right, are there good reasons to believe that God exists? This is a very important question that we all need to think through. So today, I'm just going to basically give about four or five reasons on why that as Christians, we do believe in the existence of God and that God is the creator of the universe. All right. And that creationism, rather than, I'll talk about that in a second, is probably still the more plausible view to atheism, or that there is no God, or agnosticism, or that we really don't know. All right. So, but I need to give a few disclaimers. First disclaimer is that the reason for faith in this presentation is limited to the intellectual arguments. All right. At least we have some, you know, understanding on why Christians believe what we believe, and that it is a rational faith. That does not mean that people who object or reject Christianity is on just intellectual grounds. There are many reasons why people reject Christianity. They have spiritual issues with us. They object because there are some personal issues or even spiritual issues. That will be reserved for a different time. But at least I'll try to deal with the standard intellectual questions first, and then we'll reserve the time next. The disclaimer number two is that the argument that I will present today in a very basic form is not to say that we can prove the existence of God. It merely means that we can show that God, the existence of God, is not antithetical to, let's say, science or to philosophy, and certainly not to history or morality, right? And that's where I'm going to be coming from this morning. And so it doesn't seek to prove anything. But we do, I believe, that our faith as Christians, when we say we believe in a creator God, it makes sense to us. And I do believe that it is the best or the more plausible view in the many, many competing views out there. All right? So the first reason why we believe, or at least I believe, in a creator God, is that the reality of God makes sense of the origin of the universe. Okay? It makes sense. Meaning, we need to ask the question, by the way, the arguments I'm giving today are so-called standard arguments that Christian philosophers, apologists, and biblical writers would normally use to spell out for us. All right? So this is nothing too different. So the first question we have to ask, and I'm sure, I hope all of you will have asked, where did the universe come from? Let me see some answers. Show of hands, tell me, in your view, where did the universe come from? As, you know, assuming that you don't agree in creationism. I mean, you can. I'm sure you know many non-Christian friends. What do people normally say about the origin of the universe? Huh?
Big Bang.
Big Bang? Okay. Big Bang. Huh?
Evolution.
Evolution? Okay. Evolution? What else?
It's always existed,
right? What? Yeah, yeah, exactly. Those are the more common understandings, all right? Atheists and some religious others typically say that the universe is eternal with no beginning, right? It's always been there. You can imagine, you know, what people are saying. It's always been there, there's no beginning, and there will be no end, all right? So we need to start on that, with that premise in mind, what exactly are we talking about? And so therefore, at least philosophically speaking, that if the universe is endless and there is an infinite regress of past events, in other words, you count back how many, you know, it just all the way back, and so there's no beginning, you know. Does that really make sense to us? And how would we as Christians account for that or answer that kind of a question? All right. Most Christian scholars argue that the existence of an actual infinite number of things is self-contradictory. I mean, how far can you count back if everything that has happened before us is infinite? Because the series of past events cannot go back forever in an infinite regress. All right. I'll explain a little bit more about what that means. And here, I have to clarify that when we say that the universe is eternal, or it's always been around, I'm not talking about just an idea. But when we say that the universe is eternal or has an infinite, or I'm talking about concrete, infinite events that has happened before us. Right. So this is one quote, a very long quote, from a typical apologist, spelling out why this idea of the infinity or the eternality of the universe is does not make sense. It's self-contradictory. Okay, let me read this illustration for you. Suppose that that before you, the reader, reached this page in your reading of the present book you set first to read, the one before it, and so on, going all the way back to the first page. Since the book has a first page, your coming to this page requires that you first read only a finite number of pages. More pages could be added to the front of this book to lengthen the time it would take you to get to this point. Let us suppose that you are a better than average reader and that it takes only 2 minutes for you to read each page. And let us suppose that you read continuously until you get to this page. Then, if there are only 10 pages to complete this page, it will take you 20 minutes to get to this page in your reading. How long will it take if you must first read 20 pages or 50 pages or 100 pages before this, or 10,000 pages? If you do the math, the important thing to notice is that in every case, there is always a finite amount of time it will take. When will you get to this page if you must first read 200 pages? Well, in about 66,667 hours. You do the math, all right? So there's a long but finite amount of time for you to get to this page. But suppose we now add an infinite of pages to the front of this book. When will you get to this page if you must first read all of those pages? Infinite number of pages. Okay, so the answer would be never. All right, because it just goes so far back, infinite number, that it's, when you reverse the logic, how can you even get to this point? All right, so never is the answer. So if you find yourself reading this page after completing all the pages before it, you know you've read only a finite number of pages. So this is the philosophical, one of the philosophical reasoning on why the eternality of the universe just does not make sense. There has to be some first cause. There has to be some beginning point. Otherwise, if you go all the way back in an infinite regress, you just keep going back, you know, and it doesn't make sense because, and then if you go all the way back and it just keeps going, but then if you reverse the logic, how, by coming back to the present, you're in the present, you know, it doesn't make sense that way. All right, so that's just sort of a simple little illustration why, philosophically speaking, why this kind of an idea does not make sense to believing Christians. So what we are saying this morning is that astrophysical evidence indicates that the universe actually began to exist in a great explosion called the Big Bang, some 15, 16 billion years ago. So I checked out the information with actually a physicist in our congregation. And he says, yeah, I think he says basically amongst budding physicists today, the most popular view in terms of the origin of the universe is the so-called Big Bang. All right. There are a number of other theories out there, but they say amongst physicists, this is probably the most popular theory. All right. Some 15, 16 billion years ago. So the Big Bang model requires that the universe began to exist and it was created out of nothing. Right? So there's really no so-called valid reason to believe that the universe is eternal. It began at some point. All right? So if this kind of a reasoning is valid, then that will basically counter what most atheists, agnostics, or at least atheists would say about the eternality, maybe even some religionists, you know. The point of this argument is that there must be a first cause. It has to come from something, somewhere. Things began to exist. Okay? So that's all this argument is trying to do. All right? So God, I mean, right now, is not even talking about God, but when you look at the Big Bang, it suggests that something began to happen 15, 16 years ago, 15 billion years ago. Okay, let's just, for now, we do not attribute that responsibility to a creator God. Okay? Science will probably say something happened, all right, in this explosion. So we don't put in the formula or say attribute this to God. But this next argument will build on the first argument. The second argument is that God makes sense of fine-tuning for intelligent life. Okay, so the first one says, something happened, something, there's a first cause for everything to be where they are today. So in the last 40 years, scientists, not just Christian, but most secular scientists would agree that the existence of intelligent life, that means you and me, depends on a complex and delicate balance of initial conditions given in the Big Bang. I think there are some scientists here, right? At least I can kind of see some. When the Big Bang took place, this massive explosion, the conditions that happened with this explosion basically was more life-prohibiting than it was life-permitting. Okay, this is the existence of this life is balanced on a knife's edge. Okay, this explosion, and it seems more probable that a life-prohibiting universe rather than a life-permitting universe like ours should exist. In other words, the fact that you and I are here, if you believe in evolutionism or even if you believe in Big Bang, what are the chances that this so-called explosion would sustain life as we are experiencing it today? And so scientists would say it's actually probable that it's life inhibiting than it is life permitting. Okay, we shouldn't be here is what I'm saying. All right. So Stephen Hawking, I think he was he Cambridge or Oxford? I don't remember, but he just passed away a few years ago. Probably one of the world's most eminent physicists, astrophysicists, estimated that if the rate of the universe expansion 1 second after the Big Bang had been smaller by even one part in 100,000,000,000,000, the universe would have collapsed into a fireball. I have no idea what that means, okay? But I'm just telling you what Stephen Hawking is saying. So basically, he's agreeing with this estimation that we really, the chance of life permitting things happening, existence now, it's really minuscule, right? So then we see another, I think this is a Cambridge physicist, P.C.W. Davies, has calculated that in order to be suitable for later star formation without which planets could not exist, the relevant initial conditions at the Big Bang must be so fine-tuned to a precision of one followed by 1,000,000,000,000,000,000 zeros. I don't know what that means either, okay? So yeah, the mathematicians will tell you that. Okay, so these are really where some of the scientists are coming from. So then, if this, the fact that we are here, the fact that there is life, at least life in this Earth, scientists would not count out that there could be life in other alter universes, right? But the fact that we are here, how would atheists or agnostics or people who don't believe in Christianity, don't believe in creationism, how would they account for this observation? The fact that we are here and there is life-sustaining forces going on. Let me hear some suggestions. Why do you think, how did we get here? Okay, so Big Bang happened. Then what happened? Chance. Exactly. Random chance, right? That's a very plausible, it's a plausible explanation. Random chance, okay? What else?
Natural selection.
Natural selection or natural law, right? Okay, good. That's what normally, how we're explained, okay? Or you can say it's by design. That would be the creationist view, that God allowed or created the Big Bang and set the conditions such that they are so, even though they're so minuscule, allow for the sustaining or permitting life in this universe, all right? And assuming if you do all the science and how this all came about, this is where we stand today. So these are the three main options: natural selection, chance, or design. So again, if you read books, the first one, evolution, is a very plausible thing, right? Natural selection, natural law, all right? That's one thing. And then, of course, chance, you do, again, the math or the probabilities just because this Big Bang took place, then what is the chance that it could be ending up like this, where we have humans like you and me, living very productive lives, that we are here, et cetera, for life to permit, all right? So as Christians, I won't talk about the first two, but as Christians, we believe that even though we believe that God is the best fit for the origin of the universe, so now when we see intelligent life, fine-tuned life that exists, like you think about a DNA, okay? A DNA molecule. I guess from reading the textbooks that it's a very intricate thing, it shows complexity, the doctors will tell you that, I suppose, and the scientists. How do we account for all this, that these things worked out the way they worked out, okay? So when we begin to plug in this formula that now, there must be a first cause. It didn't come from nothing. The universe could not be eternal. But then when you see fine-tuning design, intelligent life, we begin to say, oh, okay, then obviously maybe there's an intelligent designer behind all this, all right? This is the so-called supposition, all right? So this is where we're going, and there's a lot of evidence, which I don't have time to go through today, in terms of how we make sense of this so-called fine-tuning phenomena that we see in terms of human life is concerned, life's permitting, life-sustaining things that go on, you know? It just does not make sense to me that all this came about chance or if evolutionism, natural selection. What kind of chances are there? So, but then we don't end the argument there because we still have not arrived at Christianity. Okay. The third argument would be that God, this idea of a creator God, makes best sense of objective moral values, right? And so, yeah, even though you say there is an intelligent life or intelligent designer behind everything, how do we know that Christianity is the best fit, or maybe other religions have a good fit or account for this, right? The argument normally goes that if God does not exist, objective moral values also cannot exist. Okay, so then you define what exactly is objective moral values. Objective moral values refer to those values which are valid and binding whether anybody believes in them or not. Okay? Do we have acceptance of objective right and wrong in this world? How many one of you say objective, whether you would agree with this or not? Okay, you're not willing to commit. Huh? Okay. For example, do we have agreement amongst all communities in the world and all people that, let's say, the Holocaust was morally wrong? Right? Do we have agreement that, let's say, rape, murder are acts of moral degradation? Well, yeah, I think so, you know. And so now if you read some philosophy, you go back to the 19th century atheist, Friedrich Nietzsche, he would rightly say, he rightly understood that the death of God or the non-existence of God meant the destruction of all meaning and values in life. If there's no God, what then is the standard for right and wrong in this world? Right? Basically, humans, we make up our own rules. Right? Basically, that's literally what it says. And then another philosopher would say, Michael Ruse, argued that morality is a biological adaptation. Okay? No less than our hands and feet, morality is just an aid to survival and reproduction, and any deeper meaning is wrong. Okay, so in other words, the fact that, I mean, if you look at it sociologically, biologically, ethically, the reason why we have, say, you cannot steal, you cannot rape, you cannot murder, right? These are the main three golden rules of human existence. They all came about because people like you and me, you know, we are fighting for survival. And so we've made up those rules in order for the species to thrive or to survive. It's not because of some ultimate value like a lawmaker, but it's just for our own sake. Atheist Bertrand Russell would claim that ethics, right and wrong, arise from the pressure of community on the individual. In other words, the herd mentality. We follow what is right and wrong because the entire species is fighting to survive. And so we made up rules like you cannot murder, you cannot rape, you cannot steal, and you know, et cetera, et cetera. You know? And this is all natural adaptation or biological adaptation that we just basically inherited. And so therefore we have arrived at this point saying that, yeah, don't rape, don't murder, don't steal, you know. So all human societies would agree on those values. But that's all they are. They don't refer to any ultimate objective moral value, all right? So you press the argument a little bit further. Oops. So man does not always instinctively feel the desires which are useful to his herd. The herd has invented devices for causing the individual's interest to be in harmony with that of the herd. So it's what we call herd mentality. Morality is due to societal corporate pressure. You understand that? So these principles are typically what what is taught in university philosophy classes. It's basically due to adaptation and herd mentality. Okay, you in Singapore have very strict rules, you know. So you impose these very strict rules because why? You want to protect everyone. Okay, these are the standards. But if we follow the arguments of Russell and Roos, there's no reason to think that in the absence of God, no objective moral values, the herd morality evolved by human beings is objective. It's all arbitrary. Okay? That's really where it is. So you read some Japanese philosophers. So in the state of nirvana, if you're a Buddhist, they would say there's really no division between right and wrong in that enlightened state. The reason why we have ethics and rules and regulations and laws now is just basically to regulate life so that the herd can survive and thrive, right? But our question as Christians is that, do we believe in the existence of objective moral values by which everyone can agree this is right or wrong, and it's not dependent upon whether you believe in it or not? That's the real question, right? Can anyone say today that Hitler was a good guy? Maybe you can say that. Or that you can approve of the Holocaust. Or, you know, whatever the case may be. Okay? So this is really where this argument is going. And I believe this argument makes a lot of sense to me. I'm not a scientist, so I'm not going to say, well, argument one or argument two are very, very strong. I cannot say that. But when it comes to morality, I do think that this is a very good argument. If there is no God, then what's so special about human beings? Well, not much. People commit suicide, they murder, they steal, they rape, you know, they commit infanticide, genocide. That's really where the world is going, you know. And if you allow for that, I mean, basically you end up with what Nietzsche is saying, you end up with anarchy in this world, which we cannot allow. So that's basically what it is. And so we see a lot of that today around the world when there is no absolute right and wrong in this world. So I find this argument on the part of sociologists and religionists, moralists, saying, or ethicists saying that, well, you know, ethical values is just derived from biological adaptation and it's due to herd mentality that we have these rules. Okay, that's typically what people would say. So on the atheistic view, if there's no absolute right and wrong, that imposes itself on our conscience. You know, that's basically where we're going. So the raping someone, well, yeah, you shouldn't do that because it's hurting someone. So I have trouble with these ways of thinking, all right? I won't say much more. Okay, so then we come to a fourth argument. So the first one, it fits the origin of the universe. There has to be a first cause. Second one is that the universe seemed to show fine-tuning in order to support intelligent life. Third one is that there seems to be a lawgiver, an ultimate lawgiver that is a standard by which we measure what is right and wrong. There is morality in this world. If you don't, ultimately, you know, in a theoretical sense, we are living in anarchy today. And it's up to the governments to say, well, we control things, but really beyond government regulations, there is really no way of saying this is right and wrong, okay? Which is does not make sense to me. So when we come to the fourth argument, now we are coming to another, hopefully, piece of the puzzle that now we begin to look at Christianity. Okay? God makes sense of the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. Okay? This is now the historical argument that we're bringing in. The historical Jesus of Nazareth claimed to be God, which was why the Jewish authorities instigated his crucifixion at the charge on the charge of blasphemy. That's why they killed him. Okay? So how do we know that Jesus actually existed? All right, the historicity of Jesus can be established by several facts, or at least observations. One, Jesus was buried by Joseph of Arimathea in a tomb. All right, how do we know that? That's true, given the understandable hostility in the early Christian movement toward Jewish leaders. Joseph of Arimathea was a member of the Jewish high court that condemned Jesus. It's unlikely to be a Christian convention. He bought this tomb in order to bury Jesus. The fact is, Jesus' burial is attested by Christian documents as early as AD 36. I mean, he died at AD 33 or so. 2 years later, we have documentation that he was actually buried in this place, all right, which was used by Mark, the earliest gospel that he rose, that he was buried in this tomb, as early as AD 55. This is Mark's gospel, all right? So we have documentation, we have written accounts that this guy, Jesus, died and he was buried in this place, right? Historical observations, okay? There's another reason why we believe in the historicity of Jesus. Jesus' empty tomb was discovered by a group of women followers. Given the fact that the testimony of women was regarded as unreliable, that they were not allowed to serve as witnesses in a Jewish court of law, the fact that it is women rather than men who are the chief witnesses to the empty tomb is best explained by the historical facticity of the Bible. In other words, why would the biblical writers include this piece of information in the gospel accounts, if people are going to discredit anyway, but it's in there, therefore, it probably happened, right? It doesn't make sense for them to, if the Gospels are legendary, writings, it doesn't make sense for them to include this kind of bad information, to be part of it unless it was really true. This is how we normally look at things, okay? So there's another reason. So when you go to 1 Corinthians 15, when Paul is accounting for all the eyewitnesses' accounts of Jesus' resurrection, right, his appearances, he didn't include the women, okay? Because he was talking about the gospel, trying to impress upon the Jews why he believed in the gospel. He didn't include the women in there. But the inclusion of the women was only in the gospel accounts, all right? So thirdly, on multiple occasions, various individuals and groups of people, 500 at a time, witnessed Jesus' post-resurrection appearances. Okay, that should say something. I mean, yeah, maybe a few people were on drugs or something like that, and they imagined they saw Jesus talking to them. But how can you account for so many post-resurrection appearances unless something did happen, all right? So that's another reason. So here you say from 1 Corinthians 15, and that he appeared to Cephas and then to the 12, and after that he appeared to more than 500 of the brothers and sisters at the same time, most of whom are still living, he said, Paul says, though some have fallen asleep. Then he appeared to James, then to all the apostles, and the last of all, he appeared to me also as a one abnormally born. All right? So Paul says, I witnessed him. I saw him. Okay? So eyewitness accounts should say, give some credibility. Okay? The fourth reason on why we believe in the historical resurrection of Jesus is because the original disciples suddenly experienced life transformations following Jesus' post-resurrection appearances. I mean, these apostles, they weren't even at the foot of the cross when Jesus was arrested and was put to death. They ran. They were afraid, all right? But somehow, after these so-called post-resurrection appearances, they were willing to die for Jesus. They were willing to, be martyred, which all of them did, with the exception of John, who died on the island of Patmos, all right? So something must have happened to them for them to experience this kind of life-changing experience. So N.T. Wright, the archbishop, former archbishop of Durham and a Cambridge professor, he says, that is why, as a historian, I cannot explain the rise of early Christianity unless Jesus rose, leaving an empty tomb behind him. That was convincing to him, to have changed lives and multiple eyewitness appearances. accounts of post-resurrection appearances. So this is what why there are, I mean, again, this doesn't prove anything, but it gives reasons on why we should believe, right? The last thing I want to talk about here is that the fifth reason is that God can be explained or immediately known and experienced, okay? This is really not an argument for Christianity or for the existence of God. People can come to know God's existence apart from arguments simply by immediately experiencing him, okay? I think all of us have experienced that little children can come to know Jesus and accept Jesus without apologetic reasoning, without knowing these arguments, right? Older people who are not read at all, they say, I accept Jesus, and Jesus comes into their lives. And so all religions will say that we don't need arguments, we don't need rational reasons on why we believe this, 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 and that. Because we are hardwired as religious beings, we are hardwired because we are created in the image of God. They believe everyone has that propensity, that capacity, because we are religious beings, okay, to know God. It all depends on which God you believe in, all right? And so that's where most religionists will go, and it's a very supernatural experience. Philosophers call these experiences properly basic beliefs. That means they're not based on some other beliefs. They just believe because they believe, okay? It's supernatural. It's natural. Okay, it's something very private. They are part of the foundation of a person's system of beliefs because humans are created in the image of God, and we can discern him in nature and even in our conscience. You know, other religions are very moral too. They have conscience, right? Et cetera, all right? They have a sense of what is right and wrong, okay? So religious others can claim to know their beliefs in a properly basic way, okay? Just as we as Christians would do. So religious people like us may know that his or her belief in God is true, okay? So that's why you have so many religions out there today, and everyone can say that they are right. But what I'm trying to say this morning is that as Christians, yes, we can come to know God in a very supernatural way, but the use of arguments and reasons is to show why the Christian faith is the more plausible or the more reasonable way to explain the existence of God. So when we talk about it, it's, you know, there's a difference between knowing God. Everyone can say they know God or they don't believe in God. But can we show or demonstrate or, you know, have some way to defend why Christianity is reasonable and it makes sense to us, right? So I've given you these so-called five arguments. So in conclusion today, this presentation has attempted to show the truth of the Christian faith by appealing to philosophy, science, ethics, and history. And so not any one approach is going to be enough. And I'm just saying that this presentation advances a cumulative approach to defend the Christian faith. It doesn't prove anything, but after hearing some of these observations and reasoning, I hope you come to appreciate a little bit more about why the existence of God, according to the Christian faith, is a very plausible, reasonable way to look at things. Because it does accord with different fields of learning today, okay? And so this is what is called a cumulative approach, and not just scientific, philosophical, historical, or whatnot. The origin of the universe has to have a first cause, i.e. Big Bang. The fine-tuned nature of the universe suggests an intelligent designer, possibly God, as a first cause. Because objective moral values do exist or should exist, therefore God also exists as the law giver. Okay? The historical Jesus points to the truth of his death, burial, and resurrection. Therefore, Christianity, when you begin to narrow it down, why the New Testament, why Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection makes sense for Christianity. So that's the cumulative way of looking at things when you take it from a different perspective.